Hey everyone, this is Zach Weiss, and I am joined today by Zach Azan.
Hey.
And Ed Jelly.
Hello.
And it is the last Friday in the month of June, so we are doing our June content wrap-up. Before we get into it, though, let's kick things off with our wrist check. Zach, what watch are you wearing?
Right now I'm wearing the Ophion Velos, which is a watch that I have in for review for the site. You actually sent me three of these,
yes.
Zach,
yes.
And I'm currently wearing the blue one, which I think is my favorite. This is a really fantastic watch. I can't wait to get the review on the site. I'm just incredibly impressed with all three of them, particularly the blue.
So the radial brushed blue.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes,
interesting.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a fantastic watch. Just incredibly, incredibly dynamic. The amount of the quality of finishing for the money is really impressive. And I think the concept of this watch, which, not to spoil the review or anything, but it's all done by machine, and it's very transparently done by machine and very well. And it's just really fascinating. It's a fascinating watch, and I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. No. I was super impressed by it. I think I've mentioned that because I was wearing it one day before I shipped it to you on an earlier podcast, and it's really breathtaking.
Yeah, it's great.
Ed, how about you?
Continuing the trend, I have a watch that is also in for review. I'm wearing the new 36mm Laurier Falcon Series 2.
Excellent.
With the bracelet on it. I had a strap on it for a couple days. It's back on the bracelet, and the review should be up shortly, if not, you know, in podcast time, who knows, but you could be reading it and looking at the review and listening to the podcast at the same time. You could be doing all these things at the same time.
Yeah, if all goes to plan, I believe this will be going up the morning that the review goes up. So
nice.
That'll
so be, I'm wearing that. It's a lot of fun. It's a fun little watch. Down from 39 millimeters to 36. It's got the same waffle dial, a little bit different on the indices, but it's a Laurier through and through. So,
and just cool to see them play with that size. Because, I mean, I guess 30, all their other watches are 39, which is not large at all. But 36 is a markedly smaller watch. So that's nice.
Oh, yeah. What do you have on, Zach?
Well, thanks for asking. I have on, this is actually a bit of a blast from the past for me because it's a watch I just haven't worn in a really long time. This is the Seiko Turtle SRP 775. So this is the Turtle with the gold accents on it. And I have it on a Coyote Adapt. And the reason I'm wearing this is because I feel like there's been a lot of like Seiko craze lately. Those 62 Moss, like the new Prospects version of the 62 Moss, has hit some people's wrists this last week. And so there's been a lot of photos on Instagram, which have been extremely just, you know, seductive and just making me think about getting another Seiko. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to just hold on. I'm going to go back to the Seikos I have and just enjoy them. And yeah, this is such a great watch that, you know, it is very much satisfying that itch because, you know, there's obviously a lot of differences and the subtle differences really between this level of a Seiko Prospects. This is like an under 500 and like the $1,000 ones. But like in the end of the day, the aesthetics are very similar. I mean, not literally between this one, the 62 Moss versions, but like this and the Captain Willard that's coming out, there's some similarities. So this is kind of like, help me kind of get that out of my system, if you will.
Have you been successful in getting it out of your system?
I mean, I haven't bought a new watch. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Pretty close, though.
It just looks so good, you know, and shout out to James Stacey because he put up some photos of that just looked ridiculous. But yeah, you know, it's happened to me before. I've been caught up in that kind of initial Seiko heat. And, you know, nothing wrong against the watches, but then I was just like, you know, that probably was a little bit of a brash decision. I think I'll let this one sit out in the public for a while. Hopefully I'll see it in the metal at some point in the not too distant future. And then I can think about it a little more because these aren't limited editions either. So a little less pressure. Okay. So June, month of June, we have a lot of our own content to go over, some really great stuff, but we figured we'd kick this actually off. And this is kind of something different that maybe we'll do from here on out with something we didn't cover. And we have several, so there were several things that Zach, you rounded up, but you know, the thing that stands out the most, cause I know a lot of people talked about it and we don't often get to talk about these watches, is the new Patek Philippe Calatrava. So can you tell us a little bit about that watch?
Yeah, sure. This is definitely something that we don't normally cover. Patek Philippe is quite a bit out of the normal purview of Worn and Wound, mm-hmm. I would say. I think that's probably a fair statement. But still, an interesting watch to discuss, I think. The new release is it's the Patek Philippe 6007A Calatrava. This is a stainless steel Calatrava, which is really probably the most notable thing about it, just because Patek kind of famously keeps their stainless steel production to a minimum. The vast majority of Patek Philippe watches are made of precious metals. So it's notable primarily for that reason. This is going to be an extremely popular watch with collectors, and I think that it's already kind of become something of a controversial watch because of its design. I think if you look at the comments on the Hodinkee article and elsewhere,
252
on the internet,
there's just,
of them.
Yeah. A lot of people have a lot to say about this watch.
Yeah, it's I think it's very it's polarizing. You know, to say the least, because of its size, the color, the design, and that center ring. We'll obviously post a picture, but it has a fairly unique, like, kind of crosshatch pattern in the center of the dial. So this is the new Patek Philippe, and it comes in a year, when we really weren't expecting a new release from Patek Philippe. There were, rumors that were, pretty well sourced earlier this year with the cancellation of Baselworld and the worldwide pandemic that there weren't going to be new Patek Philippe watches debuting this year. And of course, Rolex and Tudor and other brands had officially announced that they weren't going to release new watches. So we weren't really expecting this. And I think it's kind of, been sort of it's obviously a surprise new release, and a lot of people are talking about it, and things worth discussing.
Yeah. God, I don't even, it's a little, I'm not a Patek person, right? I mean, this is something we've sort of established, and I'm not a Patek person in the sense that I don't buy them. I can appreciate them, but I'm not in a place in my life where I'm going out and buying Pateks, and I don't really expect to be, but you can't be into watches and not at least appreciate the brand for its history and, for its famous watches. Seeing this watch, though, and I think my initial just gut reaction was very similar to a lot of other people's, and it was just kind of like, this is an inelegant design. And flipping through their catalog, there is the 6006, which is another very strange watch that is white gold, and it sort of builds off that design. It's sort of sector dial. It's got a little bit of a sportiness to it. And this, clearly kind of takes that and goes with it. But I was looking at it, my initial impression was just, okay, it's not particularly exciting. It's a little bit generic. And then I was very surprised to see that it was 40 millimeters, which is, in my opinion, outside of the realm of like a classic dress watch. So it's not trying to be that anymore. And I think if there's anything that is a classic dress watch, it is a Calatrava, right? Like, that is the core of that. So it was just sort of confusing, it's like, what is the point of this watch? Like, who is this really for? And, I don't know if there's really a satisfying answer to that. But then on top of...
Well, I think the answer to that is it's for their best clients. It's an allocation piece.
Yeah. There's a thousand of them.
It's, it's a... Yeah, but no, you're totally right. It's kind of a weird thing as a Calatrava or a dress watch. For sure.
And it's a thousand pieces worldwide. So they're gone. They're sold. They're in the. Yeah. I don't know if they're out there yet, but they're soon to be in the safes of 1,000 people who buy Pateks. And it's $20,351. And I mean, I know it's a Patek, right? But it's like, it's a steel Patek. It just really plays into the kind of absurdity of what a steel watch is from one of these brands, because like. I don't know. That's not exactly this added value from it being steel, which is, as I say that about Patek, just sounds so absurd. Ed, what do you think of this gun?
It's just not for me. No. I don't really like anything about it, to be completely honest.
Anything.
Again, not for me. No, you know what? They even covered the freaking movement with a new manufacturer, giant Patek logo 2019 etching on the back. Like, come on, man. Like, it's a Patek. You want to see the movement. You got it covered up with, like, a glass etching. Like, I don't know. Again, not really for me. If I did have the $28,351 to allocate to a watch, I wouldn't be spending it here.
Right.
You know, I really don't have much to add on top of you guys. It's just like a little funky, a little weird, a little disjointed. I'm sure it's executed beautifully. It's probably perfect under a loop. It'd be nice to see that movement, but, you know, there's a little etching over it. Other than that, I really don't have much to add to the conversation. I'll just throw in a little shade and be done.
Fair enough. Yeah, one thing I was also actually surprised about with this, and just talking about that texture in the middle, which I believe is called like a basket weave texture, and it's the same thing that's on those Ophions that you just talked about. Though, and it's kind of hard to tell from the photos because obviously renders online are larger than the watch actually is, but it looks like it's sort of enlarged, and I believe it's stamped also. So the same process that Ophion used, like this is not a guilloche dial.
Yeah, it's very strange. Like it's weird to think of Patek using like a cost cutting measure, but to do like really good, like kind of old fashioned, you know, guilloche, like it would probably be even more expensive, you know, under like Patek's current, you know, like pricing scheme. Yeah. It's a weird watch, and I, you know, it's not for me either. It's definitely not something I, you know, aspire to own, and it's not the type of, it's just not, yeah, not the type of watch that I go for. But I think that kind of in the context of like this year in watches, it's sort of an interesting release at this particular time, just because it's, you know, it's like the one Patek release that we'll see this year, and it's a steel sports watch, and they're already gone. I'm sure you can't get
them. I was just thinking, like, that's almost the ultimate insult, is that this is the idyllic 2020 watch, given this exemplifies 2020.
In some like very weird way, it definitely does.
Yeah. Okay. So now let's go the complete opposite direction from the world of Patek and back into classic worn and wound coverage, and with a watch that I actually think is really kind of funny to juxtapose with that Patek Philippe Calatrava, because this is also a steel sports watch, also with an in-house movement, if you want to get technical, but
yeah,
one that's only a few hundred dollars. And that is the new Seiko 5 Sports without a bezel. So Zach, could you tell us about that?
Yeah, this also doesn't have the like that film over the case back. I think you can see the movement on these two. So
that's right, Seiko.
So even better. So this is the new bezel-less Seiko 5 Sports. I don't know if we've come up with a nickname for these watches yet, but if you're familiar with with last year's Seiko 5 Sports launch, which was a massive launch of new Seiko 5 sports pieces, kind of like reinventing the line, this is basically the same thing in a slightly smaller case without a bezel. And they are really nice looking, in my opinion, I believe the case is 40 millimeters.
Yeah, it's 40. Yeah,
it's a 40 millimeter case. So a couple millimeters smaller than last year's Seiko 5 sports with bezels, which should make for like a much more compact, discreet wearing experience. And these are really nice. They're kind of like a take on a field watch, I guess, but just a, you know, good, like kind of all around, all purpose kind of daily wear timepiece. And you know, a lot of different dial variants and, you know, different straps, bracelets, typical of Seiko. They offer a lot of options.
Ed, I know you you reviewed the bezel version, and I believe you mentioned that you're a fan of these, so what do you think?
I mentioned I was a fan. I was not lying.
Okay, good.
I tend to lie to you guys a lot. No, it is. I think it's very cool. I was reading a review. I think it was on Watch Clicker. They managed to get their hands on one of them, and it just looks great. It looks great on the wrist. It's smaller. It's slimmer. It's something different. It's got that kind of SKX inspired case shape with the 4 o'clock crown. But since there's no bezel, I don't think people are going to be calling fake dive watch on this one anytime soon.
Yeah.
It's more of a sports watch. It's got a generous amount of water resistance at 100 meters. You get a nice durable Hardlex crystal on top. It ships on bracelets. It'll look great on a NATO. There's a bunch of colors. You get that new applied indices look on these Seiko 5s that the SKXs did not have, which is a nice touch. I'm sure people will appreciate the day and date, unless you're an elitist or just happen to hate them.
It's classic for Seiko 5, though.
You're not really an elitist. I'm sorry. So yeah, it's a classic for Seiko. It's one of the five requirements to be a Seiko 5. You have to have a day and date display. So it's just like a nice crowd pleaser watch that I think a lot of people are going to like.
Yeah, I think these are going to be immensely popular for the brand. I mean, I would guess more popular even than the dive watch version, or quote unquote dive watch version. I don't want to start any fights. So
watch it there.
You know, yeah. But, you know, especially given how that one, you know, has the sort of contentious relationship with the 007, which was just such a favorite watch for so many people. And then it's a, you know, it's a new take on the format physically, but it's not really a new take on that watch. This one has none of that baggage, which is really good. And I think that's scaled down, like that 40 millimeter case size. And I, you know, I haven't tried it on yet. I'm really actually eager to, because I feel like that 40 millimeter case size is going to be perfect with that style of watch, with the crown off at 4. Like, it's going to be a very just appealing, you know, like you said, kind of like a field watch, but though it doesn't like have typical field watch dials, it's just like a this classic sporty, fun everyday watch. And, you know, yeah, it just, it's very exciting. And, you know, there was one other small detail, which I remember I actually didn't notice at first. I didn't notice until after we published. The minute hand has been like sort of modified. So it's like a little bit less divey, than the bezeled version, which I feel like
it's a
nice,
a little sleeker. It's got slimmer arrow. The arrow doesn't have, the side points that don't stick out quite as far.
Yeah, which I think is really nice. And, you know, something else I was thinking about with these, and, you know, I think this was also part of the other series, is that Seiko is sort of acknowledging in their own way that there is this modding culture around their watches. So, you know, the modding culture kind of builds up when the watches are more prolific, because, you know, there's no point in kind of making parts if there's not going to be a lot of people to buy them. So I feel like these are going to have a really wonderful kind of modding life after they've, you know, settled in for a little while. And I'm very excited to see what those people, you know, the Kleving modder crew out there do with this. Because I've seen some incredible mods in the last, I don't know, I'd say in the last year or so. They've gotten extremely kind of eccentric and interesting. A lot of handwork on dials and things like that to make them look patina. Like, it's beyond just a handful of stock parts you kind of stick in.
Even if you don't want to go the mod route, there are plenty of good options. There's two different two-tones. I'm not a rose gold guy, but it's kind of cool to see a rose gold and steel look.
Yeah.
I mean,
is that your favorite? I was going to ask what your favorite. No? You sure?
I like the gray one. I think I like the gray dial.
Yeah.
It's different. It's kind of like old school Seiko. I feel like they used to offer a lot of those like anthracite gray dials, and now they're kind of coming back in a big way, which is, I'm excited for that.
And Zach, how about you?
I like the gray one also. The green one is nice too. I think we've all talked about, you know, kind of the resurgence of green watches in the last year or so, and Seiko does a really nice green. I also like the blacked out version too. But they're all really well executed.
Yeah, I was going to say the blacked out one is surprisingly appealing, because that isn't just a type of watch that I typically would go for, but in this like very affordable package and with the added texture of the applied markers, like it is very cool. It's very cool.
Yeah.
I feel like the first mod I would like to see of one of these is just like a no date version. That would be just to have that symmetry. I think that'd be really great. Or maybe even a black date, but whatever. We'll see what people come out with. So from there, let's move on to, well, it's sort of a review, but it's sort of also more of a thought piece, Zach. And that was, you did something really interesting. You went into your watch box and picked out an old watch that presumably you kind of hadn't been wearing very much, and you wrote about it. And this is a very popular, well-received article. So could you tell us a little bit about From Deep in the Watch Box?
Sure. So I wrote this article about a watch that I've had in my collection for a while. This is also kind of strangely on the polar opposite of that Patek that we discussed. Yeah. This is like very much more of a sort of a traditional, you know, kind of dress type watch. It's not really like a traditional dress watch because it's stainless steel, but sort of like in that dress watch size, at least. Mm-hmm. This is a small, discreet stainless steel watch in that kind of traditional Calatrava style with straight lugs, no crown guards or anything. It's a really beautiful vintage watch that I've you know, owned for a while. Didn't pay a lot for it. And it's just kind of like sat in my watch box for a long time. I wear it occasionally. But in this period of kind of, you know, like not going out and doing anything, social distancing and social isolation, I found myself just putting on watches that I hadn't really thought to wear as much, and I was able to kind of rediscover this watch, and that's what the article is about. And it's also kind of about how I enjoy wearing a smaller watch. Mm-hmm. And a dress watch out of context. You know, I don't have anything to dress up for. You know, I work from home, and we, you know, we're socially distancing. I can go, you know, days without leaving my apartment if I want to. And yeah, certainly I'm not attending events that would require a dress watch, but there's something kind of satisfying about wearing it, even when, you know, the rest of my attire is not even, you know, close to matching it. So yeah, it's just an article kind of about like rediscovering watches that you might not you know, wear as frequently, and you can kind of get a lot of pleasure out of that.
Yeah, it's a great, I mean, if you have a big enough collection to have watches that sort of end up in that kind of like, you know, strange vault sort of section of them. Yeah. Or maybe outside of the main rotation watch box, you know. I have a similar sort of thing. Is an old Gruen that it was actually, my dad gave it to me. He had it from back in the 70s because he did some work with Gruen at the time. And it was basically, it's like new old stock. And every now and then, like, and I mean like once a year, I like pick it up and put it on. And it's such as like this charming, very fragile feeling little watch. But it's very special in its own way, you know, which yeah. I feel like these watches from that era had. And I love the design of this Certina. Just looking at a photo of the close-up of the dial, you know, I kind of wonder like, there's something familiar about it in the sense that, like, you know, it's a type of design that, you know, you kind of put it like it's sort of sector dial-y, it's sort of mm-hmm. Bauhaus, but it's also, it's very different looking at the same time. And I feel like that's not a design that you could just drop in a case now and it would be like successful. Like, it's very of the era.
Yeah. Yeah. Know? No, for sure. This is like, you know, kind of like mid-century watch design, like to a T, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. At least it's kind of like what my mind goes to when I think of, you know, like the, you know, 1940s, 1950s era of watch design. Maybe that's because I own this watch, mm-hmm. You know, so I might have, there might be some bias there, but yeah, it's a fun watch to own. I really enjoy it. It's, I'm not an expert by any means, but I don't think it's ever seen a polishing wheel. It's in really great shape. It's well worn, and you can see, and even in the photos included in the piece, you can see that it's, you know, picked up some scratches and things, but the case is in really good shape, and you know, it keeps time, which is impressive for
always good. Always
a
good
watch this age. And it's just it's a fun watch to own. It's unlike a lot of other watches in my collection. I don't own any other watches that are like this, so it's kind of special to me for that reason. Yeah.
Ed, do you have any watches in your personal archive?
Nothing vintage. If anything, I'd probably say the thing that fills that gap would be my Orient Bambino. I think like I wore it for my wedding. I liked it a lot when I got it, but it's a little dressy. My taste has changed a bit. I don't love the strap; is just terrible. It's like this really thick, weird, padded fake alligator.
Yeah, they always had terrible straps.
But going through the article kind of makes me want to jazz it up a little bit. Maybe grab a new strap and enjoy the watch a little bit more. Since the sentimental value is there, I'm never going to sell it. So
yeah,
maybe I should give it some extra love and wear here and there.
Yeah, there's kind of like, I feel like, I mean, knowing a little bit about, you know, your life outside of podcasting, obviously, like, you know, you go fishing, you have a kid, you talked about dropping, was it your phone on the pavement? Like, you know, the Bambino doesn't strike me as a watch that's like suits exactly what you do, although maybe it's sometimes nice to have like an indoor watch, like a watch you just wear inside. And that sounds so ridiculous, you know. I'm sure anyone who's not a watch collector would be like, you have a watch to wear in your home. But sometimes it's nice to have watches you just put on and wear around that you don't go outside with. I don't know, makes sense.
I mean,
to me,
when you have a toddler, everything is on the table. You know, inside is not safe anymore.
Fair enough.
But no, I like that concept, an inside watch.
Yeah, just an indoor, say, it's like slippers, but it's a watch.
My house watch.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to a review that technically was in May, so we're cheating here, but it's the very, very, very end of May. And this was a watch, Ed, that you took a look at, and I'm going to just butcher the name of it, but it was the Le Forban Malouin, maybe, dive watch. Can you take us through this one?
Yeah, so we have here a 39mm dive watch with a Miyota 8215 inside. It's available in black or blue with C3 loom treatment on the dial. It's got a dome sapphire crystal up top, ships on a tropic strap, and is available for $445. It's from a French brand called Le Forban that was big back in the 60s and 70s. They supplied some military stuff to the French military. They were kind of one of those, like, I don't want to call it like a fly-by-night operation, but one of those like smaller dive watch style operations that popped up in the 70s. You see a couple of those, you know, come and go, mm-hmm. where the watches all kind of had a similar design. They were usually sold to like a military type thing. It kind of just seemed as like when these things were actual tools and required by divers and branches of the military, and where it was a standard issue item, whereas now you probably have a computer or supply your own watch, or, you know, just tough shit, figure it out. This is one of those things that back 50 years ago was more available. So they actually rehashed the brand and came out with this 39mm diver.
So what do you think of it?
So it was a bit of a mixed bag for me. I think there was an equal number of hits and misses. There was some good things. I really like the case size, but the case was kind of boring. Like, it's just polished. The sides are flat. There's no real transitions between surfaces. Mm. The crown guards were a little small. The crown itself was small. Kind of a miss. I like the 39mm platform, but I don't really love how it was executed here.
Mm.
Ironically, the part that's hidden by your wrist, the case back, was one of the coolest parts of the watch. It had this really great old school dive helmet pattern, nice deep stamp in the back there, and it was matte finished. That was really cool, but again, it's not like, you know, you don't wear the watch upside down unless you're a crazy person
or at home.
Yeah, or at home. For your house watch, you might wear it upside down. I don't know what you do in your own four walls. That's your prerogative. But the design is kind of charming. You know, it's got this it's made or assembled in France, which I think is cool, and it's got this little stripe underneath the name of the watch in blue, white, and red. French flag. Cool little nod. I like the little anchor on the dial, but there were some things that just didn't do it for me. The sapphire crystal being the main offender. So it's a dome sapphire, and a lot of companies use dome sapphires, but I have not seen a level of distortion towards the edges nearly as bad as this. So when you look at the watch, the larger cardinal indices all have big numbers. So you have a big 12, a big, the three has a date, but a big six and a big nine. And there's like this weird doubling effect where the six on the bottom towards the edge of the crystal gets like another bump. So it looks like a six and an eight kind of mashed together. And then the nine is all jacked up, and the 12 has a similar jacked up appearance, I believe is the technical term for it.
Jacked up. Yeah.
Jacked up. And the AR coating is so blue. So between the blue AR coating and the distortion at the edges of the dial, it's just like kind of messy, and all that could be solved with a new crystal. So I think the main takeaway from the review is, for me, if you're going to drop $450 on a watch, like, that can buy you a lot of watch. I can get you a killer Seiko. There's plenty of micro brands that you could shop around from. But there is some charm to this watch. It is cool. It's got a tropic strap that it ships with, which contributes to that old school dive watch design. I think I'd like to see a version 2.
Yeah.
Bigger crown. Maybe give me like a bevel on the case. Maybe throw some brushing on it. Definitely a new crystal, maybe even acrylic. If you're going to go for something domed and you want that vintage distortion, my vote is go acrylic. It always ends up looking better, lesser distortion. You can polish it up if it gets scratched. But it was a fun watch. It's still here. It's still sitting on my desk. and yeah, I just think that the potential is there, and they have such a big back catalog to draw from that I think they could do better on a second run.
Yeah. It's, you know, looking at the photos now and barring the issues you just brought up, like, it is a very nice looking design, and
it photographs really well.
Yeah, no, your photographs look awesome of it. There's like one where you have it like sitting on a lens. That's what I'm looking at right now, and it's nice depth of field. And the watch looks really sharp. Like, I feel like there's so many mid-century divers out there, and they end up blurring together. But this one is a little different. You know, I think the use of the 12, 6, and 9 numeral, which I assume is pulled from a vintage watch or some suggestion.
It looks pretty much identical to their old version. I don't remember what it was called offhand.
But I really like
their catalog is a very similar one.
Yeah. I really like the typography they use there, like the kind of squared off numeral. It's all just very cool looking. You know, I feel like this distortion issue is kind of marked, and I feel like there were a couple ways around it. One, I mean, it's probably developing like a sapphire crystal and keeping that price point that is like a top hat sapphire crystal is probably tricky, because this can get really expensive from what I understand, because there's a lot of material loss. But like, if they'd even just actually shrunk the dial graphics in a little bit, you know, you would have let that kind of the single dome issue on the edge that's causing all that like magnification distortion
exactly
wouldn't have affected it. So there's like some workarounds. I feel like, yeah, like it's kind of like a round of refinement away from really working. But
there's one thing that I thought was worth mentioning that I skipped over. There's actually a silver ring cut into the dial, which looks really cool. I haven't seen that before. So between the outer chapter ring and the inner center of the dial, there's actually a metal shiny ring that you can see kind of cuts into the date wheel. I thought that was a really cool look. It's kind of hard to capture in pictures because you know, when you move the watch around, it kind of reflects the light in a very interesting way. So it's like a little bit of a sector dial appearance, but it actually has a cut into the dial. So you don't really see that too often. And I thought that was really cool, because I feel like I kind of just bad talked this watch for like 5 minutes, but interesting little detail. But if that was just all shrunken in, you got those numbers a little bit further away from the edge of that crystal, fine.
Yeah.
We'd be good.
Yeah. Zach, what do you think of this watch?
I kind of agree with what you said, Zach. It looks nice. Like the pictures look great. Like, you know, Ed's a great photographer, and you know, he can make any watch look really nice. And the design isn't bad, but you know, based on what you know on you know Ed's review and just kind of particularly the issue with the crystal, the wearing experience of this watch. And again, I haven't handled this watch, but I imagine it's just like not all that great. The crystal really does seem like the deal breaker. To me, it's rare that a crystal done poorly can come through in photographs. But and, you know, again, Ed's photography, like you really can see that with this watch. The AR coding and also the distortion, it's just not a good look. And there's so much else out there at that price point. You know, like a Baltic Aquascaf is only like a few hundred dollars more than this, I think, right? It's
I believe so.
Like $600 or $700. And that watch has just, you know, it's just so much, you know, better in terms of, again, not having handled this watch, but I have handled the Baltics. Like they're built really well. They're incredibly well executed. And I imagine that for that extra couple hundred dollars, you're getting, you know, kind of orders of magnitude, you know, better quality watchmaking for that price. So not really super appealing to me, but like Ed, I'd like to see like another version of this with some improvements for sure.
Yeah, and it really is actually competitive. Like that, the competition it's against really is tough. I mean, Baltic is one, but then, you know, Laurier's watches don't go above $499, and that's with a bracelet. Granted, it seems like the Neptune Series 2 is like their other watch is kind of hard to get, but I mean, when you and it, frankly, you know, at this point, I feel like I maybe used to feel bad kind of comparing everything against each other, but I mean, there are so many options now that brands really do have to, they do have to stand up. So, you know,
yeah, for sure.
But I, you know, I wish them the best of luck. I think the story is cool. It's great to see another French brand kind of pop up that also uses some assembly in France, which, you know, doing anything local not only adds a layer of complexity with bringing parts in, but then also certainly higher cost. So, you know, I'm sure some of that is there, but either way, very interesting. So next up is a watch that I definitely never thought I would see come from my micro brand, and that is the Zalos Mirage, which if you've been reading the site, you know, you'd be aware is a Swiss Tourbillon by Zalos, which is a brand that if you asked me to describe, I would say is a kind of a funky under $1,000 watch brand that with its kind of its own design language, certainly value driven, but certainly not a brand that's making Swiss Tourbillon. So, Zach, you wrote about this one. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So the Zalos Mirage is, like you said, it's a Swiss Tourbillon. It comes in at a little over $10,000. They start at $10,900 and top out at $11,900. Like you said, completely surprising. This is not a watch that I expected. I was really happy and surprised to see the press release that when you sent it over to me. It was just, when you do this, you know, every day when you write about new watches, you see so many watches that are kind of like similar in one way or another to other things that you've seen. And I think this is the first Tourbillon that I've written about for Worn and Wound. I don't know if Worn and Wound has covered a Tourbillon in this way before.
No.
Yeah. So just, it's kind of exciting and novel. And so, you know, I talked to Elshan, or communicated with Elshan, the founder of Zalos, through email to kind of ask him some questions about this watch and how it came to be. And he's always kind of aspired to own a Tourbillon. And as a, you know, the owner of Zalos, he had a opportunity to produce one of his own. So in a limited batch, he was able to make this Tourbillon, which is just a really cool, modern, you know, skeletonized, you know, take on the Tourbillon. It uses a Le Jus Perret movement, which was custom made for Zalos, and it's very cool. And it sold out like very quickly. Like there's a market for this watch, so the experiment was successful. And I'm genuinely happy for Elshan, because he this seems like kind of a passion project for him, and it's just cool that he was able to accomplish this and sell 10 of these things. It's great.
Yeah, and he sold, 10 in a day, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, they went real quick.
And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, just to put this into context also, like, if you're not familiar with Le Jus Perret, you know, this isn't some weird obscure Tourbillon maker or Swiss movement maker. They're actually owned by the Citizen Group. They are used by the finest watch brands out there, either for creating new movements or modifying movements. So this is like it's a really incredible piece of, you know, of mechanics in here. It's also kind of remarkable that he was able to access them. You know, I don't know how easy that is. I'm sure that there are other brands out there trying to get their hands on these kinds of movements. So, you know, for a small brand to pull this off really is quite remarkable. And something he did that he's done on his other watches that I really love that he also showed off here is his use of interesting case materials, which is something I feel like almost gets kind of brushed over when you talk about Zalos. I mean, I certainly didn't stop and mention that as like something that stands out about them. But he uses these incredible case materials like Timascus, which is like Damascus steel, but in titanium. So it's folded metals on top of each other. It is it's very expensive material. It is very exotic looking. And it's perfect in this context because, you know, if you didn't know anything about the brand, you know, like his previous watches, and you put this on a table with other, you know, luxurious modern Tourbillons, you'd be like, oh yeah, like that's the one, like that's the exotic one of the group, you know.
Yeah, it also kind of ties a line from this watch, which is at the top of the Zalos line, to other watches. Like the Tourbillon obviously is very different for him and a new thing, but these exotic case materials are kind of like that thread that kind of weaves these watches together.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't look like he changed his design language to make this. Like, he didn't try and play Swiss Tourbillon. Like, he brought one into the Zalos vocabulary.
Exactly.
So, Ed, if you're not going to get the Patek Philippe from earlier, how about this one? Would you consider
I mean, if there's a gun to my head and I got to spend $28,000, I could walk away with almost three of these for the price of one Patek. No, you know what? It's kind of cool that, like, it's clear, I think, that this is a passion project. Like, it's not like they had a limited edition of 1,000 and they have to find 1,000 customers. Like, Zach, you said, the creator of the brand has always wanted a Tourbillon or a Swiss Tourbillon, and he did it and was able to probably fund his watch by selling the other nine, which I think is a very, very cool thing.
Yeah.
it's definitely not for the masses. I mean, the titanium Damascus is a very loud kind of, you know, bright blue and bright purple stripes are kind of wild. Yeah, I think you got to be a certain kind of person to pull that off. But looking a little closer at the watch, like, it is very cool. The skeletonization is cool. The bridges are cool. It's got a very cool flow to it. The brushing on those, you know, the skeleton bones, if you will, are very intricate and nice looking. I mean, again, I got to stop saying it's not for me, because a lot of things are not for me, and just appreciate things for what they are. Maybe kind of be, you know, grow as a person here on the podcast. But it's I think it's cool. I think it's cool that they were able to do this, especially when their average watch is, you know, a couple hundred bucks. I do like that they didn't make any compromises to their design language. Like, the lugs are very clearly Zelos. I've had my hands on a couple of them now, and you can see similarities between this $11,000 watch and the $400 watches that they produce. So I think that's cool.
Yeah, very much so. I'm excited to see one of these in the middle at some point. You know, I imagine Elshan is going to wear one on his wrist the next time that, you know, we hold a wind-up and he is there. So, yeah, really looking forward to that.
Yeah, he confirmed for me that he kept one for himself, and it's going to make an appearance at the next wind-up. So
excellent.
Looking forward to that.
That is excellent. And, yeah, you know, I mean, similarly, like, this is not to my personal taste if I were to, like, write it down. It's like, I'm not really into skeletonized watches, super exotic things, whatever. But, like, I think if, you know, and just to add, on top of Timascus, he also made some out of, and I'm going to mess up this pronunciation as well. Let's see, it's Mokume.
You want me to do it?
Mokume, yeah, please.
No, you got it. You had it.
Oh,
sorry.
Mokume Gane?
I should have faith in you.
Okay. Yeah. which is also equally as insane looking. It's kind of copper and golden looking and striped. Like, I mean, I would rock that, you know? It's crazy looking, but that is so cool. Anyway. Awkward silence. So moving on to a guide. This month we wrapped up the Nostalgia Machines guides, which were written by Caleb Anderson. And so this was a series of three guides where each guide focused on a different price point. But the theme that united them was that all the watches in these were vintage reissues. So obviously something we talk about a lot on the site, and we've talked about on the podcast, vintage reissue watches, vintage inspired watches are the trend of this kind of, you know, time right now in watches. So we wanted to kind of look at ones that were maybe some of the originators of it, some, you know, just great examples of watches that were pulled from the archive. So this isn't so much a, you know, a watch from a brand that didn't exist back in the day that kind of pulls from that design era, so much as every watch in here existed at one point and then was brought back by the brand or has a continuous line through. So there's way too many watches here to talk about. I recommend you look at all three guides. I mean, it's over, yeah, they went 10, 11, 12. So we have over 30 watches when you put all three guides together. But I thought it'd be kind of fun just among the three of us that we kind of like picked out a watch from each that we particularly like or thought maybe was a really good example of one of these quote-unquote nostalgia machines. So, Zach, was there one that really called out to you?
So, for sure. A lot of these watches called out to me, which was a little bit surprising for me, actually, because I'm kind of on record as being not the biggest fan of this particular type of watch that is a, you know, kind of a direct and, you know, vintage-inspired watch. I tend to, I tend to gravitate more towards contemporary designs and actual vintage watches and not mm-hmm. new watches made to look old. It's just my personal preference. But a watch that definitely stands out to me is one that actually there's a review forthcoming. I think I've spoken about it on the podcast before, is the Longines Heritage Classic Sector Dial. I really like this watch a lot. That'll be clear when the review hits the site. I miss wearing it. It went off. Went back. To Longines a few weeks ago, and I wish I still had it to wear because it's just a really fun watch to wear, and it does a really nice job. Longines in general does a really nice job of updating these old designs in a modern package. So to me, that's the standout, you know, from the three guides, I would say.
Very good choice. And yeah, I mean, given that you just had it and now it's gone, I can understand why it's like left a void for you.
For sure.
Ed, I happen to know you own two of the watches that are even featured in these guides, so I'm curious as to what you would pick.
Yeah, so I made some notes on this before, and the two that resonated most with me would be the ones that I own. So I have a Doxa Sub 200. I wrote the review of it. I sent it back. I bought it. Had to have it. I love it. I've been wearing it a ton. It's like a perfect summer watch. I have it on a gray NATO, and it's just great. The waterproof level, vintage looks. The crystal is like half the reason I bought the watch. It's beautiful. Never really said that about a watch crystal before, but
I mean, comparison to the crystal we talked about earlier, like it is
the polar opposite.
Yeah, a theme is emerging here. Yeah, crystals today.
I just love the watch, and it's cool. I didn't know at the time. I don't think I wrote it in the review, but it actually did reference an old Doxa 11804-4, which I believe they referred to as the Shark Hunter. That's why the black version is called Shark Hunter Black. It doesn't say Shark Hunter on the dial. That'd be kind of cool, but it doesn't. It's pretty similar to this vintage Doxa, and this is like an old Doxa as far as Doxas go. This was early 60s,
yeah, very early. You know,
birth of dive watch kind of era stuff. But this one, they've bumped it up to modern specs. You got an ETA 2824 inside, the dome sapphire crystal. There's a sapphire bezel insert, which is cool. Even though the bezel loom absolutely sucks, it's there. but, you know, it just looks great during the day. The shine is great. The bezel action is great. The curved lugs are excellent. The brushing mixed with the polished bevels are great. I just love everything about this watch. And the beads of rice bracelet is just so comfortable. I'll just go on and on about it, so I'll stop
You really
myself.
Like this watch, yeah.
I really like I've been wearing it a lot. I mean, I put my money where my mouth was. I wrote the review. It was a good review of the watch, and then I went out and bought it. I think that kind of says a lot.
Certainly, certainly.
And are we doing round robin, or should I just say the other one's a Speedmaster? I own a Speedmaster. It's pretty much the same.
Just go for it.
It's pretty much the same Speedmaster that's been in production, except for, you know, minor tweaks since the beginning of its time. And I think that's part of the reason why I opted to pick one up was because it's a timeless watch. This is the watch I bought the year my son was born. He can have it eventually. I can pry it from my cold, dead hands. That's the idea there. But no, I love it. And it's just, it's pretty much a new vintage watch. And some people complain about that because it should have been updated, blah, blah, blah. No, it shouldn't. The Speedmaster with the Hezolite acrylic crystal should be the same thing. I like that you can still buy more or less the same watch, same dimensions, similar specs, similar movement, hand wind. Everything is just the way it should be from the beginning.
Yeah, can't argue. Can't argue with the Speedmaster. I was very aggressive about making sure we included a Speedmaster. I was just like, okay, there's got to be a Speedmaster. We got to have a Speedmaster. Because, yeah, I mean, the Speedmaster is like, as you said, it's timeless, but it's also... while there have been Speedmasters that perhaps have responded to the trend of growing, you know, vintage interest, such as, like, let's say the 60th anniversary or something being so exact, thus the core Speedmaster has always been there. You know, it has almost been in a face to the modernization of a lot of other, you know, brands and types of watches. Like, you know, there's quartz. This is always a manual wound. Automatic chronographs. Nope, it's a manual wound. Sapphire crystals, nah, acrylic, you know, like, it has just always been in the face of all those things and in a very good way. And it paid off in the end, obviously.
Oh my God. Imagine they did a maxi case Speedmaster. I think I'd die a little bit inside.
Yeah. I mean, you could kind of argue they sort of have with the slightly larger models, but it's, they're surprisingly well, like, proportionally increased in size. Those are like, I'd have to try one on again, but
fit the Master coaxial in there though. There's a totally different movement.
Yeah, yeah. A couple of years ago, they came out with a series that were more kind of based on the racing dials. And I remember trying one on at the Omega Boutique when they had a little event and thinking, like, wow, like, much like how the Speedmaster at 42 doesn't wear like a 42, like at 44.25 or whatever it is, it doesn't feel that big either. Like, they're very wearable watches. So for my choice, and I mean, you already took the Speedmaster. Thanks.
Sorry.
Yeah. No. This watch actually took me by surprise, and is in the most recent iteration. So the kind of over 3,000. This is an expensive watch, and one that frankly I hadn't paid a lot of attention to because it's outside the price point that Warmont typically covers, and it's a brand that, you know, we've mentioned once or twice, but it's not something we typically write articles about because, you know, they just start well above the kind of 5K sort of soft threshold we have. And that is the Glashütte Original Specialist CQ. I remember seeing they came out with this and thought, oh, another brand doing their own version of the Vintage Diver. But the more I look at this one, particularly the version that we included here, the more I kind of have just fallen for it. It's 39.5 millimeters. I should also preface by saying that every Glashütte Original I have seen in person is exquisitely finished. Like, they're absolutely stunning watches. I think they're bordering on underrated. You know, they certainly get kind of overshadowed, I feel like, by, you know, the Longes of the world. But they have that series of watches with the kind of, they're part of the 70s or 60s series, I believe, and they have those kind of sunburst dials. They are like the most incredible things you've ever seen. Like, at Wind Up Watch Fair last year, somebody was wearing one, and like I saw it from across the room, and I was like, I can't wait for this guy to get over here because I think that's one of those watches. And then he did, and I was like, oh my god, like it is a breathtaking watch. So with that said, and I can use my imagination to sort of picture what this watch would be machined like, it's a 39.5 millimeter dive watch with just this like really great vintage looking dial, massive numerals on the even numerals, and then bars in between them. But everything is really like perfectly oversized, you know, like it's bordering on ridiculous looking, almost in like a cool way, you know, and like kind of like the way the Oris Diver 65 is like, you know, the original version, like it's almost too much, but it's not. And it's kind of really cool because of that. You know, I feel like this has that going on. And then I was noticing, just looking at now, the hands are almost identical to the hands that were on the Le Forban, just in the design. So you have the kind of fence post hour hand and the big arrow minute hand with the kind of bisected loom on that, which I just thought that was interesting. But yeah, I don't know. This is just really speaking to me. Like, I could see this. Frankly, I would take it off the bracelet because I don't really like bracelets. But like that on like a black nylon strap would just be absolutely killer. So
yeah, it's a very cool watch. I agree with you that Glashütte Original is a little bit underrated. The watches in person are just you know, fantastic. And yeah, that's a really good pick. It's a very cool watch.
So there are a lot of other watches that came out this month that were really, you know, pretty awesome. I mean, Oris had a solid bronze chronograph. Hamilton did some work with the movie Tenet, which, Zach, I know you're very excited about.
Yes, very excited.
And we'll talk about that later. I mean, maybe when the movie comes out also, we can kind of come back around to that and we'll know a little bit more about the context of that watch.
It got delayed again today.
Oh,
so
no.
It got pushed back to the middle of August. So I'll be surprised if this movie comes out in 2020, but I'm always down to talk about the new Christopher Nolan movie. So
yeah, well, we'll definitely cover it. And, you know, as you pointed out in that article, we don't really know much about the movie at this point. Longines did an interesting Spirit collection, which I kind of felt like there was sort of their soft sort of competition for Braymont. There is something kind of there. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but this sort of like aviation chronometer at that price point. I just thought that was an interesting launch from them. But we wanted to get to the question of the month. So put this out on Instagram the other day. We'll be doing this, you know, every month. We've done the last two. Keep your eye out around the end of the month. I'll put out an Instagram story asking for questions. And this one comes from @bulovas and bolt actions. And the question is, if you could see a new movement come to market, what would it be? Zach, do you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. I think that if I could just magically make a new movement appear, I would like to see a more reasonably priced GMT with a local jumping hours. I think that's something that a lot of people in the watch community would like to see. GMT watches have seen a huge resurgence in the last few years. I feel like every brand has kind of a value-oriented GMT watch out there, and there are more coming. We've got one you know, that'll be on the site next week. By the time this podcast comes out, it'll already be on the site. There's a great, you know, charm to GMT watches, but the usability of these watches is really enhanced if you can jump the local hours. Mm-hmm. And with when you can only independently set that 24-hour hand, it really limits the functionality in a lot of ways, even if you're not a traveler or care about time in other parts of the world. Local jumping hours is just a really useful complication for even if you stay put. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of opportunities to use that complication. So that is something I would like to see. It's a complication that's available on, obviously, Rolex GMTs. Omega has GMTs with local jumping hours. Grand Seiko does as well. But really, outside of those three brands and Tudor, they're quite rare. So if
one that gets forgotten about a lot, and I think it's like largely because they just don't develop a lot of watches with it, is the Alpina GMT. So they actually in-house module, and those are probably the most affordable mechanical watches with a jumping hour hand, I'd imagine.
I think that you're probably right. Yeah.
But yeah, they just haven't utilized them super well. So they're in a couple watches that are quite large. And then they did do this really cool kind of barrel shaped design that has a jumping disc in the middle, or rather the GMT hand is a disc in the middle. But those just like didn't get a ton of fanfare when they came out. It was sort of an odd release, as I recall. But yeah, God, if they could, you know, utilize that in a classic, you know, a smaller case or whatever, I think Alpina would have a hit there. But generally speaking, mm-hmm. I agree with you. And it's just like how there isn't, you know, also third party, you know, movements, Seiko or Miyota doesn't have something like that available for micro brands, is unfortunate. Cause I think, you know, GMT watches end up, or GMT movements end up in watches that are often very similar. You know, I think that's probably because if you're going to do it, you want to be successful with it, and people don't really try and reinvent too much. So I'd be curious to see what people did if they just had a lot more kind of opportunity to use them. But Ed, how about you?
So my kind of magically snap and it appears movement is kind of a play on Zach's as well. Not GMT, but maybe just like a better all around automatic, affordable and readily available movement with some of the better features. Like, I would love a power reserve greater than 42 hours. Mm-hmm. Like the Seiko 6R35 is not in terribly expensive watches and it has a 70 hour power reserve. I'd love something like that. The Hamilton H50 has a crazy power reserve, but it's hand wind. It'd be cool if that was automatic and not tied down to that one group of brands. I think something like for me that would probably have the biggest impact on my watch collecting and watch enthusiasm would be if micro brands had access to a wider range of movements within a price range that won't put these things into unaffordable territory. Because I tend to switch between a couple watches every week. Like I really won't wear more than three watches probably in a week. I'll kind of gravitate towards one and then maybe swap one in a couple days or whatever. But to go back to the watch box and have that one, you know, out of power after a day and a half can be a bit of a bummer. And sometimes I'll just grab a watch because it is still set to the proper time, even though I don't necessarily want to wear that watch just because I'm running out the door or something. So for me, automatic, big power reserve, readily available and affordable would probably make the most difference to me.
Yeah, understandable. When I had the green dialed Seiko, that was the, you know, part of the tribute to the Crown chronograph, you know, having that 70 hour power reserve in there was really, really nice. And that was really, I think, the first watch I've like owned for a longer amount of time than like a loaner model that I got to experience like an extended power reserve on. And it really makes like just a general difference in, you know, you're wanting to wear it almost, because it's like if you have a bunch of watches lined up you haven't worn and one is running and keeping good time, it's kind of like the easy option. And it's just really, I mean, it's just a good user experience at kind of the end of the day, you know? And whenever you see a new movement come out, it's kind of like, well, why did they stick with the 40-hour power reserve? There's all these other technologies out there. A lot of brands have mastered it, making, you know, expanded power reserves, from, you know, 70 hours, 80 hours, up to 3 days, 5 days, 8 days, 10 days. You know, just, I fully agree that that is like a place that people should put their R&D into.
I mean, otherwise you're spending like Panerai money or like Auris Pro Pilot X money. And it's, again, it's not automatic. Mm-hmm. It's awesome, but it's, you know, still hand wind and it's not available to just use as a platform to build your watch or to be swapped into something more affordable.
Yeah. Always keep in mind the Christopher Ward in-house movements because they, you know, they use it themselves. They don't obviously have the other brands using it, but that's the SH21. And those are 5-day chronometers. They're a little bit larger, so those watches tend to not be below, I think, 40 or 41 millimeters. But they're also in the, like, you know, I want to say they start maybe around $1,200, and they often have sales and things. So if, like, Power Reserve is your grail, like, at least that is available now. So for me, I find thinner watches to be just so much more appealing on the wrist, and thinner movements, you know, allow for kind of proportionally thinner watches, including in watches that you don't always want to be super thin, like a sport watch. But there's, you know, only so many ways they can do that. And one of the ways that I've just have always found to be really elegant, at least both aesthetically, it seems like practically, would be a micro rotor. And I kind of wonder why those haven't been a little bit more prevalent. It could be an engineering issue. It could be an efficiency issue. But, you know, I in a universal Genève pole router, you know, dating all the way back, like, those are incredibly small, elegant watches that look like they should be hand wound, but they are automatic because that movement was kept thin by having that, you know, micro rotor that doesn't cover the entirety of the movement. You know, conversely, you have, you know, like Nomos has their movements, which are pretty thin. And, you know, when you just see what some of the watches that they have, you know, how thick they are, you're talking about, you know, 7-8 millimeter thick watches that just wear so well and they self-wind. So that's just something that I whenever I see a movement coming out, I'm just always like, why isn't somebody trying to do a micro rotor? Or, like, you know, why aren't they trying to get thinner without getting to that kind of, like, you know, Piaget or, you know, kind of fragile point? You know, at a certain point it just becomes absurd, and it's not about, like, durability or usability. It's just about achieving that thickness, and that's not what I'm talking about at all. I just, you know, right now one of the thinnest movements that's really accessible to brands is a Miyota 9015, and that's, I think, around 3.9 millimeters. So, like, if they could just shave off, you know, get down to that, like, 3.2, however they did it, like, it would just make for extremely comfortable watches. You know, if you think about movement watches with, like, Pizu 7001s in them, which is a hand-wound movement, you know, such as a Kostova Antea, like, that watch is about 7 millimeters, you know, thick from top to bottom, and it wears like a wafer. You know, it's wonderful. So,
yeah, micro rotors are awesome. It'd be great if there was a more readily available, affordable micro rotor movement that brands that we cover had easy access to. It'd be a game changer for sure.
Yeah. And they're just elegant to look at, you know, like, one of the things that's great about a manual wind movement is obviously you can see the whole thing. And so, you know, you have some brands using skeletonized rotors to kind of show more of the movement off. I guess there's one brand out there, one or two brands out there that have, like, the kind of, like, it a rotor that just spins around the outer edge and isn't even attached to the middle. But that's, like, hyper rare as well.
Swatch System 51 has a rotor that spins around the outside of the movement. $150.
There you go. But that's it's still mounted to the middle. Oh, right. Which was with the Bulgari is a micro rotor, you're saying?
The Octo Finissimo, I think they have one with the rotor around the outside.
And there you go. There's all these options. yeah. No, or, you know, for a micro rotor, Valcher makes a micro rotor movement, which, you know, you can find in, like, the Slim Dermes, which is an incredibly beautiful watch. And if you, you know, happen to have, I think those are around $6,000, you know, a very good choice, but
yeah,
not everyday money. So.
So we want movements for the people.
Yes,
movements for the people. That's the theme. Movements for the people.
Yeah. So Seiko, Miyota, please come out with micro rotor jumping hour GMTs with 5-day power reserves, and we'll be good.
Yeah, you've got buyers here.
Yeah, three. We'll keep your company afloat. All right, guys. So that wraps up June. and we'll be back in a month to see what July was all about. Thanks.
See you guys.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Worn and Wound podcast. If you enjoyed the show, then please leave us a review on iTunes, and also be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Looking for a new watch, a strap? Then visit windupwatchshop.com, and of course, head over to wornandwound.com daily for great watch content. Music tracks Nowhereland and Inspired are by Kevin MacLeod and are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0.